Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ray Henley in Washington. The United Nations conference ended this evening in San Francisco. A charter, a constitution, for a new world organization has been written. That charter tonight carries the signatures of men who went to San Francisco from many lands, who represented all of the races of the world, and practically all of its creeds. These men, these delegates, assembled in San Francisco with one thought uppermost in their minds: to prevent World War number 3. Did they succeed? It may be too early to try to answer that question tonight, but we can begin to examine the finished product of the San Francisco conference in order to know its good points and also to be prepared for its weaknesses. And so tonight, the American Broadcasting Company has assembled for you a round-robin forum of distinguished editors representing various sections of the United States. We bring these editors to the microphone so you can hear their seasoned and expert opinions on the accomplishments of the San Francisco Conference. You'll hear from Mr. Ralph McGill, editor of the Atlanta Constitution, Mr. Ralph M. Blagden, editor of the St. Louis Star-Times, Mr. James M. North, Jr., editor of the Fort Worth, Texas Star-Telegram, Mr. Hugh A. Fogarty, editorial writer of the World Herald in Omaha, Nebraska, Mr. John Charles Thompson, editor of the Wyoming State Tribune, also Mr. Herbert L. Lewis, executive editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press and Dispatch in St. Paul, Minnesota, Mr. Phil Parrish, editor of the Portland Oregonian, and finally back to our national capital to hear from Mr. Ben McKelway, associate editor of the Washington Evening Star. So to begin our swing around the circle, we hear first from the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, Mr. Ralph McGill, speaking from Atlanta, Georgia.
The new world charter approved at San Francisco is stronger than the League of Nations, both structurally and spiritually. This fact, I think, was obvious among the delegates themselves, many of whom came to San Francisco with a very real fear the conference might fail to achieve its purpose. The fact the conference succeeded testifies eloquently to the fact that all over the world there is a greater demand for peace than existed at the end of the First World War. It was this one fact which enabled the conference to accept the affront of Argentina's entry and to smooth out other difficulties. I think it fair to say that Russia, the nation which made more concessions than any other participant, demonstrated a sincere desire for world peace. Russia's actions should silence the criminal gossip in this country by irresponsible persons that Russia wants to make trouble. The charter must now be ratified, of course, and by now we must all be aware of the plain and inescapable fact it cannot succeed without the United States. Woodrow Wilson's League might have succeeded had we joined it. Certainly the course we took did not lead to peace. No great world power can isolate itself if it wishes. We must participate in world affairs, and the fact that this charter has an excellent chance to receive an overwhelming endorsement from our Senate may well mean that the end of the year will find the charter ratified by all peace-loving nations. Meanwhile, it seems to me that newspapers and radio have the responsibility of interpreting the charter to the people so that all may know and understand its meaning and its power for peace.
Now let's go to the great metropolis on the Mississippi to hear from the managing editor of another great newspaper, Ralph M. Blagden of the St. Louis Star-Times, speaking from St. Louis, Missouri.
When 153 delegates signed the Blue Morocco-bound San Francisco Charter today, two worlds came into being. The first was already here. It is the old world of jealous, fearful national sovereignties and of special power alliances. The new world is that of international cooperation, of the San Francisco Charter and of Bretton Woods. These two worlds are in existence at the same time. They exist because the nations have not yet conquered fear. No nation dares step at this moment entirely free from the old world into the new. The San Francisco Charter is far from a perfect document. Nevertheless, if ratified, it means that for the first time in history, the United States would actively cooperate in removing the cause of war. Thus, the one greatest defect of the League of Nations would be removed. America's presence, coupled with provisions for the application of military force against aggressors, would represent the chief advances of San Francisco over Geneva. The San Francisco Charter could be a completely effective instrument for policing at least the historic aggressors who are now outside of the world organization. But for even this limited purpose, the five great powers in the Security Council must always stand together in a showdown. They must also be willing and ready to act against the first threat of aggression. If Germany, for instance, succeeds in chipping one ally off the Big Five bloc, she can stymie action against herself. That is the greatest danger of the veto power reserved to each of the Big Five. A chief weakness in the Charter is the fact that it is not legally obligatory upon the Council to act at all. In an era of appeasement, for instance, when the democracies have returned to their easygoing ways, with a Chamberlain or Daladier perhaps in the saddle, one or two of the great powers might simply prefer to let matters drift rather than to risk military action. As the League was, in a sense, a law in search of a police force, this Charter is a police force in search of law. Therefore, the success or failure of the San Francisco Charter depends upon the wisdom and vigor of the statescraft of the member nations. It will also depend upon the people behind that statescraft. If the machinery of San Francisco and Bretton Woods is used and perfected, confidence in the new world of international cooperation will evolve, and the old world of nationalistic hedges may wither away. San Francisco is, at best, a transition government. The isolationists will attempt now to commit the world to a third world war by a campaign against this charter. Their tactics will be primarily those of delay. Several senators have already asked that the Senate defer action until the peace conference. If the American people are foolish enough, however, ever again to prefer the internationalism of war to the internationalism of cooperation to prevent war, they will go along with the wreckers instead of with the architects. Otherwise, they will back the San Francisco Charter to the hilt with the full realization that they have taken at least the first step toward ultimate civilized world order.
Next, we go to the Deep South for James M. North, Jr., editor of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, speaking from Fort Worth, Texas.
Statesmen of 50 nations, after 8 weeks of intensive effort at San Francisco, have drafted and signed the charter of a new world league to maintain international peace, to take collective measures for the prevention of war and the removal of causes of war, to prevent aggression, to settle by peaceful means international disputes, and where such efforts fail, to employ collective force. The Charter likewise provides for the exploration and improvement of economic conditions, for trusteeships for nations not yet self-governed, or those that may be detached from enemy powers, and for the consideration of human as well as property rights. It would be impossible, of course, to analyze this great document in the time allotted on this broadcast. But two questions uppermost in the public mind may be touched upon. How good is the Charter? What are the chances of the success of the League thus created? Statesmen of the nation participating generally agree that the Charter itself is a vast improvement over the League of Nations covenant, that it is strong where the League covenant was weak. Where the League of Nations covenant was idealistic, the United Nations Charter is both idealistic and realistic. Where the League of Nations Covenant was predicated on the theory that the League could maintain peace without resort to force, the United Nations Charter is based on the belief and a demonstrated experience that has cost the world millions of lives and billions of dollars, that force may be necessary to maintain peace, that only the combined force of the great powers can guarantee the world against war, and that nations should bind themselves in advance to supply forces against aggression where necessary. What are the chances of success for the League? Success of the League will depend not upon the Charter, as fine a document as it is, but upon the spirit and the will behind it. The determination of the nations that join and the people of those nations to maintain peace and prevent war. One of the most promising factors for success is the likelihood that the United States will become a member. It was not a member of the League of Nations, and that idealistic attempt at world peace largely failed because of it. Another is a recognition that this nation and the world cannot stand another global war such as we are now engaged in, that war must be prevented, that the millions dead and maimed shall not have sacrificed in vain. The United States, Great Britain, Russia, the nations that won the European War, with the help and cooperation of France and China, can maintain world peace and prevent war if they work together in peace as they work together in war. The prospect that they will is good. The spirit shown at San Francisco is in itself an augury of future success. But as promising as is this prospect, it does not justify this nation in again relying upon the fallacious theory that war can be prevented by destroying the weapons of war. The United Nations League, in time, may make possible great reductions in armament. It may prove that all international disputes can be settled by peaceful means. The whole world hopes that it will. But until that time comes, our nation, while cooperating to the fullest and throwing the weight of its great power into every effort to maintain peace, should keep itself prepared.
Now we hear from Mr. Hugh A. Fogarty, editorial writer of another of America's leading newspapers, the Omaha World-Herald, speaking from Omaha, Nebraska.
The Middle West, it is safe to say, will line up solidly behind the accomplishments of the San Francisco Conference, although fully conscious that the charter born of the conference labor is far from perfect. This section of the Middle West will, I believe, accept the Golden Gate Charter on the same theory that a hungry man will devour a dry crust if no steak is available. And the Middle West, sharing the world's hunger for peace and post-war security, is willing to settle now for a dry crust, with the hope that corn-fed steaks may be enjoyed at later banquets. The Midwestern attitude toward global cooperation is perhaps best expressed by two typical Midwesterners: our good neighbor from Missouri, Mr. Harry S. Truman, and our good neighbor from Kansas, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. The earnest determination of Mr. Truman to contribute to world peace is now well known. General Eisenhower was voicing orthodox Midwest opinion in New York recently when he warned that the problems of peace must be solved or we shall all be lost. Most Midwestern residents appear to realize that only genuine and intelligent cooperation can carry us to global security. They realize, too, that isolation is a dead word in these days when even Shangri-La has a busy military airport. The United Nations Charter appeals to a Midwestern mind as providing an alphabet for peace and security, but an alphabet with some of the letters missing. It falls short of the Atlantic Charter in embracing justice and human rights. It fails to extend the horizons of hope for colonial and subject peoples. The veto power held by the permanent members of the Security Council seems to be a dressing up of power politics in top hat and tails. But for all its imperfections, the San Francisco Conference does represent a forward step in human relations, for it gives promise that the greatest nation on earth, the United States, is about to become an active citizen of the world, in peace as in war. And the fact that 50 nations could agree upon a charter at all is in itself a monumental achievement. But let us remember, as President Truman mentioned a few hours ago, that San Francisco is only a beginning that will mean little unless suspicions, mutual distrust, and clashing ambitions are uprooted among the great powers. And the necessary first step toward the elimination of suspicion and distrust has not yet been taken. That step involves the opening of the channels of communications between all peoples everywhere. It requires a free press and a free radio wherever men reside. These constitute a must feature for any program that hopes to achieve security, that hopes to translate San Francisco into a peaceful reality for all mankind.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer, I hope to a happy landing. That observation is mine. What is to follow essentially is the comment of my associate in our organization, Roy F. McPherson, editor of the Wyoming Eagle. He supplies the thought, I voice it. The San Francisco Conference has completed the task assigned to it, the drafting of a charter for the proposed World Security Organization. This is encouragingly significant, but of greater significance is the fact that 50 nations voluntarily participated in the undertaking, that they cooperated in the writing of the charter and in the construction of the framework of an international security organization. The odds were against them, but they were willing to try. 50 nations, the greatest as well as the smallest, recognized the futility of war and the urgent need for a joint effort to prevent war. The import of the conference lies in this recognition of the need for international collaboration. Recognition must come first. The thought precedes the deed. Desire comes before effort. In other words, here is demonstrated a worldwide will to maintain worldwide peace. This is the fundamental significance of the San Francisco Conference. 50 nations, speaking in unison, have said, I will. This, not the nature or form of the charter, is a momentous fact. Have the representatives of the 50 nations been successful in their efforts? Have they set up the machinery that will implement their will to outlaw war, to establish international justice, to ensure international tranquility, to provide for the common defense of the member nations, and to promote international welfare? This is a question no person at this time can answer. Even the delegates to the conference, though optimistic, are not sure. For the Great Charter has many imperfections. It is a conglomeration of compromises. It is the work of many minds holding differing opinions. Not one of the 50 nations is wholly satisfied with the product turned out by the conference. Every one of the 50 took exception to some of the charter's provisions. Every one of the 50 reluctantly made concessions. But this is not surprising, for the same can be said of every city ordinance, every law passed by any legislature, Congress, or Parliament. What is astonishing is that 50 delegations were able to compose their differences, compromise their views, and write a charter to which each of the 50 was willing to sign its name. They kept trying when the going was hard. They persisted even when agreement seemed hopeless. If one nation had voted the conference, there would have been reason for despair. The revelation of will to get together and to stick together gave the world a valid basis for hope. For few of us are familiar with the details of the World Security Organization blueprinted at San Francisco. Broadly speaking, the representatives of 50 nations attempted to do what representatives of the American states did at Philadelphia in 1787, and precisely the same reason. The Security Organization and its charter are comparable to the Union of American States and the federal constitution. The question in every mind is, will this 50-nation organization work? Time alone can answer that question. But we believe that the outlook for this Union of Nations is as bright as was the outlook for the Union of States in 1787. For there was more unity and less bitterness in San Francisco than there was in Philadelphia. This is a strong statement, but it will have to stand. Of the 13 original states, one state sent no delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Of the 65 delegates chosen to the 12 states, 10 did not attend. Of the delegates in attendance, 16 declined or failed to sign. The record in San Francisco is better. All of the 50 nations chose delegations, all of the delegations attended the conference, and not one declined or failed to sign. Surely the World Security Organization is getting off to at least as good a start as did the United States of America 158 years ago. This is not proof that the new order will function as planned, but it furnishes a basis for hope. One basic indisputable truth was recognized and acknowledged when the United Nations were invited to send delegates to San Francisco. It is this: there are only two places in which controversies among nations can be settled, on the battlefield or around the conference table. Either problems are talked out or they are fought out. There is no alternative.
You have just heard John Charles Thompson, editor of the Wyoming State Tribune, speaking from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Let's go back a bit east to one of Minnesota's Twin Cities for a report from Mr. Herbert L. Lewis, executive editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press, speaking from St. Paul, Minnesota.
The delegates and the 50 governments they represented at San Francisco have a great achievement to their credit. They have drafted a charter that may, if ratified by those governments, mark the beginning of a new period in world history. Of course, in judging this charter, we have to recognize that it is a small beginning, a cautious start. This proposal represents only a small fragment of the world government which many persons hoped would come out of this war. But we must remember that great and lasting changes are usually a matter of growth. Even the Constitution of the United States was a product of 4 years of bad experience under the Articles of Confederation, and it was hardly in effect before the amending process began, and it has been going on ever since. The framers of our Constitution were accused at the time of being more interested in founding a strong government than they were in ideals and principles of democracy. But what they were actually doing was trying to meet the practical problems that had been encountered during the experimental years of Confederation after the Revolution. So too were the men of San Francisco.
they have tried to produce an agency or vehicle for international cooperation. And in their search, they have been trying to meet the practical problems involved in collective action among nations. The problems that were highlighted by the experience under the old League of Nations and much else. They have begun by recognizing what is undoubtedly true, that international cooperation for peace must be founded, in the first instance, on the continued harmony and unanimity of the great powers, hence the veto power. If the big powers ever fall out on any major matter, that's the end of the world organization. But this is not in itself enough. The conference has also tried to work out a satisfactory relationship between the big powers and the small and the middle-sized powers. And overall has emerged a mechanism for carrying out the will of the peace-loving peoples of the world. It is a much more effective charter for maintaining the peace of the world and for cooperation in solution of world economic and political problems than was the covenant of the old League of Nations. For all of its safeguards and vetoes, it contemplates the use of force if necessary to put down international disorder. It is true that merely having an organization does not guarantee its use for the purpose for which it is designed. But if the governments of the world will use this vehicle in the same spirit and zeal for peace that has inspired the delegates in their task, we can be quite confident of a future. And if those governments listen to the profound wish of the peoples of the earth and respond to the hope for an enduring peace that binds together all decent humanity, that is what they will do.
From St. Paul, we travel to the great Northwest to hear from the editor of the Oregonian, Mr. Phil Parrish, speaking from Portland, Oregon.
Jan Smuts made a remark the other day that everyone should remember. He said to bear in mind that at San Francisco, the nations have been dealing with international machinery, not with international solutions. The grand old man of the conference really put his finger on it. I sat through considerable of that meeting at San Francisco, saw the dramatic clarification of differences in the first days, witnessed the restoration of goodwill and the working out of compromises. I emphasize that what we have achieved at San Francisco is exactly what Marshall Smuts calls it, machinery. And don't confuse machinery with ultimate ends. Plato did some mighty fine planning in his Republic, but republicanism was going into eclipse for centuries. The French wrote some mighty fine constitutions in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Then, when they got in the mood, made an inferior constitution work. It is the will behind that counts. Actually, it would have been shameful, inconceivable, if the San Francisco meeting had achieved less than a reasonable charter which took into consideration the weaknesses of the old league. The conference did not fail. And in the writing of the new document, I cannot say too much for the efficiency and harmony of the United States delegation. The delegates from both sides of the political fence really left off their differences at, well, the 12-mile limit. We are proud of the manner in which they performed, sometimes under great provocation. But the clarification of differences to which I referred earlier is also a reality. No one who followed in detail the events and discussions at San Francisco can have failed to see with ever-increasing clarity that the United States and Russia have emerged as the two colossuses of the new world, and that somehow they must reconcile their differences and the differences which they represent if the United Nations organization is to function through the coming years of social and economic crises. The machinery has been accomplished. The operation of that machinery depends upon the wills and hearts of men. I tremble to think of a world in which this machinery breaks down. Let's not permit it.
Now we go across the country to our nation's capital for a report from Mr. Ben McElway, associate editor of the Washington Evening Star, speaking from Washington, D.C.
Ladies and gentlemen, while this discussion is prompted by the successful end of the San Francisco conference, the important thing to remember is that this end is merely the beginning of a new attempt to keep the peace of the world. It is a fine, encouraging beginning. The representatives of over 50 nations have joined together in a spirit of goodwill, sensible compromise, and devotion to the paramount cause of learning to live together in that uncertain world which will be left when the fighting is over. They have agreed on the structure of the international machinery by which they hope to prevent future wars. The machinery itself is something new, and being new and untried, it cannot be perfect. To some of the idealists and the perfectionists, it is full of contradictions. But it is not designed for a perfect world, nor for a world that has as yet been able to give practical effect to the best aspirations of mankind. It is designed for a world that still is full of inequalities, injustice, cruelty, and hate. A world that is prostrate and suffering from the continuing devastation of the most destructive of all wars. The wonder is that in these conditions, 50 nations, allied by the grim necessities of war, have been able to agree on the outlines of a plan for peace. The success of this beginning at San Francisco, and this is what we always must remember, will not depend on the wisdom, nor will it fail because of the imperfections of the Constitution which is being signed by the United Nations. It is not the diplomats or the statesmen who will determine the success or future of the beginning which has been made at San Francisco. That success will depend, in the end, on whether our people and the people of the other nations throughout the world are in good faith determined to stop fighting wars, whether they are willing to make occasional and relatively small sacrifices in national pride, in economic advantage, and in selfish ambition in order to avoid the overwhelming sacrifice later on of the lives of our children and the destiny of our grandchildren.
Thank you, Mr. McKelvey, and thank you, gentlemen, all of you, for coming to our microphones this evening. We want to thank you for pointing out so clearly that what San Francisco really has given us is a great opportunity. This is Ray Henley in Washington.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Accomplishments of San Francisco, a discussion of the San Francisco Charter by well-known editors throughout the United States. This is the American Broadcasting Company.